Somebody call 911. Travi might get fired at the end of the year, and the burners are present on Twitter. Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. And we woke up on this Monday morning preparing to have a nice discussion about what the likes of George Mason, Loyola, and Richmond did on the court in the first week of conference play. And then Twitter decided to entertain us through the workday in what was probably the best day of A10 Twitter since maybe when Loyola told everyone what the nicknames to not call them by. We're getting close to this being the day that we found out about the Fire Mooney billboard, though.
This is up there. Where did George Mason move up in the mid-major madness top 25? Because that was pretty good last week when they announced they were 19th. They had to move up after a good week.
Ooh, I meant to check that. And all respect to Nick Lorenzen, who literally might be the hardest working person in and around college basketball because he does all of his coverage stuff. And then is a manager for a team that's like an hour away from where he goes to college. But George Mason was basically just tweeting a really fancy graphic that said, "Hooray, Nick Lorenzen thinks we're good." Because I'm pretty sure that that's just his poll. I don't even think people vote on it. I think it's just his personal rankings.
I mean, after that happened, I texted you that the St. Louis men's basketball account should tweet that somebody from 3-Bid League doesn't think they're going to the pillow fight. Although a few more interesting things have happened in St. Louis Twitter land since then, so maybe we should just get into that.
Yeah, so for those of you who either just don't really go on Twitter or didn't waste away half of your Monday afternoon following this, the West Pine Bills, pair of wonderful guys covering the St. Louis Billikens, who have been certainly critical of Travis Ford, but with stat-based reasons for the most part, posted some direct messages that they received this morning from two separate burner accounts, basically going after them for their criticism of Travis Ford. And then Zach Miller decided to try to sleuth on this, found a pretty flimsy connection that made him believe that one of the accounts belonged to Travis Ford's son. Ford then admitted on his radio show later in the day that yes, it actually was. And that was kind of the end of that. And that alone would have been a funny story. But then a whole nother burner account came out. Sean McDonald, who began to give the reasoning that St. Louis has gone down the tubes because Joe Biden is in office. And I'm trying to find all of the tweets. They're kind of scattered now. But there were two great ones. The last being, and I quote, "Moreover, if Trump is reelected, our big donors will support our NIL and we will have stars at SLU. It's not Ford's fault that we can't pay players what he wants." While we're talking, I'll try to dig up the original. But it's basically the idea that Biden being in office is preventing the proper flow of NIL dollars and bringing down St. Louis's roster. And Matt, he says that the money's going to start flowing if Trump gets back. And so what I'm left to wonder, does that guy who runs around the Cardinals stadium make big donations to St. Louis athletics? Because maybe once he gets to stop paying his legal fees, that money can go back to the Billikens.
Man, I didn't think we had to bring the St. Louis Cardinals into this, but it's just a wild world out there. Of all the excuses you see fans make or like pointing the fingers, Biden is a new one, at least in the college sports world for me. But just a really interesting day all around in St. Louis Twitter. And the most surprising thing to me, I just want to go back to Travis Ford admitting that this actually happened. I'm surprised he just didn't just deny this and say, like, this happens all the time. Like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and a quick aside here, the other tweet, and I quote, "Again, you joke, but having him in office totally ruins NIL donations and disposable income. It's no coincidence that Ford's tournament appearance was with Trump." And the quick aside, like on a serious note here, because you mentioned it is amazing that Travis Ford admitted this, and I never thought that he ever would. But this goes along with some of the stuff that I said earlier in the year with him talking about this openly. I think he's safe. Like, I think if you're really that worried about being fired, you don't want it out there that your son is out there attacking your own fans, trying to like sway public opinion back in your favor. And I've been of the opinion that he's not getting fired all year.
I think you make a good point there. And I also think it's a good reminder just of the personal side of things. And look, like college basketball or coaching any high level college or professional sport, it's a tough business and it's very visible. Like people can't go out and see what you and me are doing at our desk jobs, and no one's really going to care if we don't perform that well. But we can all see that St. Louis is having a bad season. And I would say it's definitely got to be tough for them to be going through that. But on the other hand, you might be right that it sounds like he's got a big buyout, and maybe St. Louis is going to try to give him more time just with the financial investments they've made. And I think the other side too, like, I know some people have complained that the St. Louis Athletics Administration is being very quiet on the matter, but I'm not really sure what they're supposed to say. Like, you're not really going to see the university throw the coach under the bus while the bad season's happening. At least I can't think of that happening very many other places.
Yeah, and I think what's honestly best for us who are looking for content out of this league is for St. Louis to continue to be bad this year, but then keep Travis Ford. Because the Twitter discourse for the next 3 months will just be hilarious if that happens. And then we get to the serious business of after this 1 year rebuild from hell, which we saw coming in the summer was going to be rough. It was obvious from last spring that they were going to be bad this year. I trust Travis Ford to put together at least a middle of the pack team next year. If he comes back, I just don't see him finishing 12th or 13th back-to-back years.
I wouldn't think so either, but I didn't really think it was going to happen this year, and I think I picked them 9th or 10th, so I wasn't all the way out like you were going into the year. But I don't know, it is just kind of disheartening. I feel like a program like St. Louis should never really be in the bottom three or four of the A-10. And I know when he got there, they were recovering from just a terrible situation. And the first couple years of his tenure, I think, is very excusable. But the A-10, they kind of need like St. Louis, and then I would say Dayton and VCU are kind of the big three teams that just have to be good for the conference to be one of the top mid-majors.
You say that and it's right, but let's ignore the fact that he's coaching Duquesne, who has a long history of being awful. But you look at Keith Dambrot's specific history, and you would never, ever in a thousand hell frozen years believe that he would lose 17 straight games. And then the next year he bounces back and they're sixth. Like this just happens now with this amount of roster turnover, and unless you're knock on wood, Anthony Grant, who ever since year one has just been a lock for the top four, you're going to have a terrible season every once in a while. So I don't like, I put that as just a black mark, whether he finishes ninth or whether he finishes 14th. And if they suck next year, then you probably got to get rid of him.
Yeah, I guess just the difference I would say with Duquesne going through that 1-17 season, like even then they weren't expected to be that bad, and they just had a bunch of transfers, guys that were fairly productive at their old schools. And I mean, like you said originally, we just knew going in, St. Louis didn't do enough to bolster the roster. They have, what, two guys who are not ineligible this year that couldn't even play. So just a mess all around.
I mean, look, we knew they were wrong, but they were voted sixth in the preseason poll.
Well, someone also voted for them first. Expectations. So.
But I want to go back to the fun part of this, which is Sean's theory that this is Joe Biden's fault. And it's more so an issue that the conference has started to fall off and these good St. Louis teams can't get at-large bids anymore. That happened before Biden came into office. I think you got to look back to Trump and that tax cut bill that came on under his watch. Now just allowing more money to flow to the rich people who are financing these major college institutions so that they have more money to collude together, to form more mega conferences, to bribe the NCAA under the table for more bids. Or if you want to go even farther, let's go back to the Obama administration. And you can look at that and say, yeah, well, the six bid year was under him. Well, just like economics, like you can't really credit or discredit the president for bids. They just don't have that much control on a granular level like that year over year. But I'm still disappointed in him for not letting his Justice Department go ahead and file an antitrust suit against the Big East for their attempted merger with Xavier and Butler. You could have made a huge case that they were trying to form a monopoly of football-only Northeast basketball schools, and that was just not right for economic competition. That Justice Department challenged all kinds of mergers. Why couldn't they have done it for the Big East?
Yeah, but then we never would have ended up with the 2-0 Loyola Chicago Ramblers, so in the end, years later, it all works out, right?
Yeah, but we'll see in 3 weeks if we're still happy about that move.
Well, let's talk about that now, because one of the big storylines of the first week of the season is that I think we had a couple just surprising performances around the league, and we can go ahead. There's some on the good end and the bad end. I think we already talked enough about St. Louis, but you know, with the positivity, Loyola going 2-0 in two coin flip games, George Mason 2-0, 13-2 overall for their best start in years at the beginning of the Tony Skin administration. And then Richmond starting out having a bye on Wednesday night, but pulling out a huge one against St. Bonaventure for probably their most impressive win of the season to date. Just going through these teams, what surprised or impressed you the most so far?
The team I'm most impressed with at this point, and it's really no hesitation, is George Mason. They're going to get a double bye. Like, I became convinced of that this week, and I know that they didn't play the greatest two opponents this week. They kicked LaSalle's ass in the second half and then tore apart St. Louis. They're going to have to play tougher teams, but they're just reinforcing the fact that they're probably the highest floor of any non-Dayton team in this league now. Other than the fact that their offense just stunk against Charlotte, they've come to play every game. Like, throw Tennessee out the window. They were in Thompson, and that team might be a one or a two seed. Like, you're gonna get kicked in the teeth most of the times that you play that game as an A-10 school. But they just have this consistency that we are not seeing from the problem children of the top of the conference, the VCUs, the Duquesnes, the St. Bonaventures, the St. Joses. It's so much to do with the fact that any questions about Keyshawn Hall just need to be gone now. He's a bona fide superstar. He's done it twice in conference play at this point, 27-13 against LaSalle, 22-8 against St. Louis. And I look at his game log, and it takes me back to a huge question that I raised this offseason. I scoured his UNLV stats. I was desperate to find someone who covered the Mountain West at that time to ask them what happened that last year he had three games in January where he was awesome in all of them, and they just fell out of the rotation. And we find out months later by his own admission that he was horribly out of shape. those days are over. And George Mason has a dude that, quite frankly, was overqualified to end up on their team. He is going to tear apart this conference for years to come. And we saw it yesterday with Dayton struggling after the Kobe Elvis injury and Daron Holmes basically just dragging them through that game. When you have an elite, elite talent, it doesn't matter as much what's around him. And between him and the fact that this interior defense is clearly, clearly real, after continuing to put up great stats there in these two games and then against an elite interior scoring team in Tulane, George Mason has the two foundational pieces they need, plus a baby soft schedule the rest of the way.
I was thinking about this just before we started recording, but other than Daron Holmes, who I think is pretty obvious right now, is there any other player that's pretty close to a lock for first team other than Keyshawn Hall? I mean, just with his consistency and putting up these huge games already, I don't feel comfortable locking anyone else in, but just with how well George Mason's playing, and I guess it kind of hinges on them just not collapsing and staying thick in the double bye race over the next 2 months. But just with the stats he's putting up, both offensively and defensively, it just seems hard to imagine him falling out of the top five or six most productive players.
Well, Reynolds.
But let's
also give the caveat for our first team, because the actual conference first team, like James Bishop's numbers are good enough that when you combine that with his reputation, he's going to be on the first team. Because if you come into the year as a known superstar and you're clearly one of the 10-ish best players in the league, you end up on first team. Like, that's just how it works. But yeah, right now, Keyshawn Hall is probably the second best player in this conference. And then it's Reynolds, and I think Matt Cross might be lingering right below them at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that'll definitely gain more clarity over the next couple weeks. But just watching Hall against St. Louis, I mean, a team that has absolutely nobody with a prayer of stopping him one-on-one, was just really impressive to watch. And he kept getting and-ones, getting to the rim. I was a little bit nervous. I think everybody probably was on Wednesday night, just with that being the early game of the night, Mason traveling to LaSalle. And I think the Explorers hit five fouls before the first media timeout, and it looked like it was already beginning, where the LaSalle Explorers were just going to ruin a team's good non-conference. The defense, though, was just remarkable, where Mason went from allowing 43 points to just 19 in the second half. And really, they shut down St. Louis most of the game, too. But I think the Billikens kind of piled it on in the final 3 or 4 minutes when the game was out of reach, but they're getting more offensive production than I ever would have expected, mostly on the three-point shooting end. I didn't think Hall or Amari Kelly would be making so many threes. Ronald Polite starting to catch a little bit more fire on offense. I mean, we kind of knew the defense was going to be solid going in, but they're really coming together. It's just a well-rounded team. There's not a ton of weaknesses right now.
Yeah, and a big part of the first half defensive struggles against LaSalle is Dunphy threw them a really unexpected knuckleball with Ryan Zan moving into the starting lineup, a guy who I don't think anyone on planet Earth thought could shoot. And then all of a sudden he hits four jumpers in the first half because they were just leaving him open. But I want to go back to the most important point you made in that whole thing, that St. Louis had no one to guard Keyshawn Hall. And I would actually argue that Terrence Hargrove Jr. is one of the best guys to throw up against him in this whole league, because what have I said over and over again? The most valuable thing you can have in the A-10 is an elite, properly built power forward, because so few teams in the league have the guy to match up against him. There's Nate Santos, and Duquesne has a few options. I guess maybe Kawani, but like, all of St. Joe's power forwards are too slow. They can't go to the four-guard lineup against him. St. Bonaventure, actually, Charles Pride, Barry Evans, and Asamoah is probably one of the better groups you're going to have going against them. But half the teams in this league don't have a guy who can properly go up against Keyshawn Hall.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of his matchup nightmare. He calls himself the big guard, I think, and he really does. Like, what is he, 6'7", 6'8", and he handles the ball so well. It's just impressive to watch him.
Before we move on from Mason, I want to ask you because I've toiled over this question in my prep today. Can they win the league?
I would say it kind of hinges on Coby Elvis for Dayton, just because I think everyone would obviously agree Dayton's the most accomplished team this year, and they're right now a couple of votes outside the top 25 after going 2-0 themselves. But we saw the Flyers struggle a little bit without Coby Elvis after he suffered a knee injury early in the UMass game on Sunday, and hopefully he's able to come back soon. It didn't look too serious, but he didn't play at all in the second half. And without him, we just saw the Flyers have maybe their worst offensive half of the season, where they could not penetrate the Minutemen zone. And I don't know. If he's out for an extended period of time, we'll find out pretty quickly, I think, how well Mason could match up against them.
Well, I'm going to go with the caveat of let's assume Coby Elvis plays like, I don't know, 13 plus conference games. Because if all of a sudden he's out till like late February, then there's like six or seven teams that could win the conference at that point. But for Mason, I'm still skeptical of the ceiling. That they could go win the 14 or 15 games necessary to go gun down a fully loaded Dayton team. And for me, the one way I change my opinion on that is if they go out this week against tougher competition, VCU at home and then Richmond on the road, if they can take care of business against those two, and most importantly, if Ronald Polite, who was awesome again against St. Louis, after looking like he was getting it back against Tulane and then putting up two stinkers in between, if he can just give back-to-back elite performances here, I start to believe in their ceiling. Right now, I think they're like an 11, 12, maybe 13 win team. They'll take advantage of their schedule, and they're probably the second safest bet for the pillow fight for the double bye at this point. But I just struggle to see them having the high-end performance potential that like a St. Bonaventure or St. Joe's still has amidst their struggles.
Yeah, but at least in terms of getting to those 13 or 14 wins, part of that is just avoiding the bad games. And we've seen that from the other teams, where St. Joe's just opened the conference season with a loss to Rhode Island, which is about as bad as it gets right now in the A-10. And then St. Bonaventure has been playing much better lately, but they have a loss to Canisius on their record, where George Mason doesn't really have anything like that. But we'll find out quickly. I feel like this VCU game, as early as it is in the season, is one of the most important games of the year for both teams, because we'll really find out how legit George Mason is. It's a home game that they really should win. But VCU's season is kind of going off the rails right now after a shocking 0-2 start, losing both games at home last week. And thinking that they might start to figure things out, having their full rotation back on the court. I mean, if George Mason gets through this next stretch, they have VCU at home, at Richmond, at GW, and home for St. Bonaventure. If they get through that 3-1 or better, they could be in really good shape to get to 14 wins.
Yeah, and let's remember this weird little piece of this. Dayton, 3-4 against George Mason in the Anthony Grant era.
Yeah, really bad.
And I want to close it here because we haven't even said his name in this whole analysis. And I feel like we've kind of forgotten about him because absolutely no one besides the Mason fans themselves are powering the hype train whatsoever. They might have hit a bona fide grand slam with Tony Skin. Like, this might have been a program changing hire for how well they've started out, and the fact that, unlike your typical mid-30s coach with a ton of Power Five connections, hot name assistant, this dude's an alum. And he's the one in 100 dude that, if he's incredible as a guy climbing the ladder, he'll probably stay for a much longer run than we ever expected, say, like Kim English to do. And that's the ultimate rarity of college basketball.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's really, this is the most relevant George Mason has been in 10 years of being in the A-10. And it's fun to watch. I mean, really the only other comparable time is when they beat Maryland 2 years ago, when they've had this much excitement. So it's all just a matter of if they can keep it going against stronger competition.
I mean, but this might just flat out be their best team in the A-10 era.
It's looking that way. We'll see. But another team that is definitely the best team in the Atlantic 10 era, Loyola Chicago, 2-0, already halfway to last season's win total, I'm pretty sure. The big difference, though, these were more difficult games for the Ramblers. Basically two coin flips going at St. Louis and then home against Duquesne, which was a really solid win where they were in pretty good shape throughout the second half. I feel like I need to issue an apology here because I had no confidence at all in Loyola winning these tight games that could go either way. And all of a sudden, they're riding a 4-game winning streak and things seem to be coming together a little bit.
Look, I've hyped up this team just about as much as anyone from the preseason to not jumping off the ship throughout the year after some of those horrendous bye games in the non-conference. They got a tough 3-game stretch coming up here. Home Richmond, the Jesuit Jam at St. Joe's, and then home UMass. Go prove it to me for certain here, Loyola. Like, just don't get your ass kicked in 3 straight games here, because what we've seen from them this year, would you be surprised for a second if they lose these next 3 games by a combined 60 points?
You know, I actually think, yes, surprisingly, I would be. But the only reason for that, they're actually starting to play some great defense. And in particular, that Duquesne game, holding the Dukes to 67 points in a super up-tempo game. And Duquesne, one of those teams that has the potential to light you up in a hurry. I kind of just don't, at least right now, I mean, I do look at Loyola's schedule, and 4 of their 5 losses are by double digits. So a lot of those were against good teams. But I'm kind of feeling like they're past the point of just getting embarrassed, as they were frequently last year. I think they at least have the defense to stay in games. Their rim protection is still just outstanding with Adelican and Rubin. And I don't know. I mean, it is certainly a grind over the next 3 games for them. But I'm not sure how many of those games they're going to win, but I'm feeling like they can play with some more competitiveness.
So I remain skeptical because so much of their terrible performances in the non-con are still somewhat unexplainable to me. But the 3 reasons to start to believe: 1, Alston is clearly healthy.
Mm-hmm.
He's starting to look like the borderline all-conference dude that we saw last year. And for the second straight season, he was problematic for Duquesne. 2, Valentine has just figured out that you have to have Adelakun or Rubin on the floor basically every second of the game, and that anything else just really doesn't make sense given the construct of the team. And probably the biggest one is that Jaden Dawson came back from injury looking like a new man. He is a true 3-and-D two-way weapon who all of a sudden is just like doing secondary playmaking stuff. Like, he's giving them the steadiness that we had hoped for from Greg Dolan, crossed with Jalen Quinn's spectacular athleticism. And we finally hit the point that one of the wings from that vaunted super athletic recruiting class from last year is finally starting to make a difference for this team. And they needed a mega athlete on the wings with Norris, and Des Watson's a great athlete, but he doesn't give you any shooting. They needed a kind of a do-it-all guy on the wing. I thought it might be Jalen Quinn. Everyone thought it was going to be St. Thomas last year. It's not a question anymore. It is Jaden Dawson.
Yeah, I think he kind of gives Loyola the best of both worlds between Dolan and Quinn, because he has that great playmaking, like you said, but also has the lowest turnover rate on the team out of guys who actually play a lot of minutes. And that's another key thing. Loyola still, it's frustrating to watch them play. How many times in the Duquesne game did they just step out of bounds? Because it had to be at least three. I mean, they make careless turnovers. They don't really value the basketball, but it's still so much better than it was last year. And offensively, it is starting to click. Their top 10 in the country in assist rate. Sometimes I feel like they are almost a little bit too patient and making too many extra passes, but it's led to more open looks and they're shooting a better percentage. So yeah, I do think having Dawson, he's been starting the last six games now, and certainly seems like he's going to be a staple of that starting lineup and rotation the rest of the year.
Yeah, and the other team you mentioned, Richmond, I really just don't have much to say about them right now, but they play Loyola and George Mason this week, so if they're playing well, we'll have plenty to talk about with them come next week.
I just think with Richmond, real quick, their defense was terrific against St. Bonaventure, and this was coming off the heels of the Bonnies just lighting up VCU for 89 points at the Siegel Center, which has to be the most loud in that building in a long, long time. But yeah, no, Richmond just playing some solid basketball. They should be getting Delonnie Hunt back pretty soon. I mean, Jordan King and Neil Quinn is a really good two-headed monster. And also just wanted to shout out, like, Jai Bailey, all of a sudden, after kind of just being glued to the bench the last 4 years, has blossomed into a really good defender on that Spiders team, probably the best individual on that end, and he's actually scoring some points now and producing offensively, so nice to see him finally getting that bigger role.
Yeah, and once they get Hunt back, which shouldn't be too far away, they might be able to finally get a little bit of kick from the bench. I'm assuming they'll move Michael Tyne back there, but they've just been relying so much on their starting five to this point.
All right, well, I guess we have to talk about some of the surprises in a bad way, because we had a couple teams go 0-2 that we didn't really expect. I think, you know, St. Louis, we aren't that surprised, but both Duquesne and VCU, two of the consensus top five teams going into last week, looking like they're in a little bit of trouble. I guess, where do you want to start? Who are you the most concerned about right now out of that group?
So that Wednesday night, I wrote off both. I wrote off both performances. Duquesne, as happened in the Nebraska game, Clark, Rozier, and Dixon all get their second foul around the same time in the first half, and the effort kind of dropped. And then the second half, they couldn't hit a shot. They were getting out hustled. It was just sloppy. And you take it as just that was the game from hell. And that's your, like, every team other than maybe Dayton, and honestly, well, it'll happen to Dayton, but they just might win the game. Every team in this league is going to have 1 to 3 road games where they just play like garbage. It's just what happens. It's weird that it happened in the first game of the conference play and not in the middle of the dog days, but you write it off. VCU got their ass kicked by a dude that they are not constructed to guard in Chad Bennett. He is a horrible nightmare of a matchup for those two good defensive centers, but still skinny defensive centers who he just bullied like children on a schoolyard. And so you flip it to Saturday's games. The Duquesne performance was sure as hell not encouraging in any way, but the rotation was really weird again. We can talk about that here. And Grant and Clark both sucked offensively. And those two are not going to be that bad on the same night, basically ever. So I hesitantly shrug my shoulders despite the fact that that team odds say is going to be 0-3 since they play Dayton next. VCU, those last 7 minutes against GW are unforgivable. They got one stop in the last 7 minutes of the game, and it wasn't even a good stop. They just ran pressure at Darren Buchanan in the backcourt, and I think he just got thrown off guard and just committed a really stupid travel. And that was it. And we heard all offseason about the vaunted Odom offense, and I more so than maybe anyone believed that once they got Bairstow and Bamisil back, that we'd see that offense. And they've come somewhat close to what we hoped it could be. But their defense, quite frankly, has been an atrocity since those two started playing big minutes. And you start to look around and wonder why. Maybe it wasn't the team defense that was great. Maybe it was some of the individuals. And three of the most important individuals to that, Zeb Jackson, Michael Bell, and Kwani Kwani, have been the guys who have lost minutes because of these two returns. And they're, I think VCU is going to have no choice against George Mason but to start really aggressively leaning on either Kwani or Bell, if not both, a lot more in that game.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think for VCU, there's just so much expectation and anticipation of getting their experienced guys back. And I mean, you even said they could win the A-10 tournament last week, and now that seems hard to imagine. Currently, they're sitting in dead last in the conference and conference only defensive efficiency, just barely better than George Washington, who really wasn't much better on that end, but they just had the final word and James Bishop made a ridiculous shot. Yeah, I mean, you might be onto something. I mean, one thing that comes to mind too with Bamisil, like he was putting up points on that GW team 2 years ago when we last saw him in the A-10, but he was also a big part of that horrific GW defense. And I don't know about Bairstow. I mean,
although he was probably the best defender on that putrid unit, but they were,
the best out of nobody though. It didn't lead to a lot of wins for them. Yeah. I just think the biggest concern too, this was what I talked about coming into the conference season. Like the Siegel Center just hasn't been a tough place to play this year. VCU has not done a good job at all of protecting the home court. I can't imagine they've ever lost five home games in a season of the A-10 era. I'd have to double check, maybe in Rhodes' first year. But, I mean, all of a sudden, they have to start going on the road now where it's only going to get tougher.
They haven't played a road game yet the entire season.
Yeah, they might be they have to be the last team in the A-10 to do that.
I think they're the second to last in the country who still haven't.
Yeah, it's a problem. I never would have imagined, like, what kind of sick world are we in where 8-7 VCU is going on the road to play 13-2 George Mason, who's trying to play for a conference title over the next 2 months? That is supposed to be the other way around.
And the one last thing I want to say about VCU, we mentioned the George Washington heater to end the game. And for anyone who hears that and says, well, GW has a pretty good offense, and that's kind of true. They have pretty good offensive players who don't always play well on the same day. But just go back and watch crunch time against Maryland Eastern Shore or Navy or any of those December games against bad opponents where they struggled to put them away. They couldn't score on, like, we could go assemble a unit of the five best defenders in the A-10 podcast universe, and I'm not sure they could have scored on every possession for 7 minutes against us the way that they were playing crunch time offense in those games. Like, this is eye-openingly scary. Even the Fordham game, where they were better, but they had chances to put that away in regulation, and I think it was the second overtime. It might have been the first, and they couldn't do it. It's been the story of their year that their offense is really good for about 35 minutes and then goes to hell. And they completely reversed that trend against VCU.
I know a while ago, You mostly predicted that VCU is going to be the team with bad metrics that would ruin someone's season because they had the talent to beat any given team.
And they
I'm kind of thinking that's
probably are going to ruin someone's season at some
they
point.
might, but I think GW could be that same team, though. I mean, we've seen them lose some horrible games. They already opened with the game of the year against Fordham, but still a loss that's going to hurt them down the road. But it just kind of feels like when their offense catches fire like that, I mean, they could contend with pretty much any team in the country, including on the road. Or sorry, not in the country, in the conference. They're not beating anybody.
I thought of this earlier today. GW is the cocaine team. The highs are unbelievable. They scored 110 points the other day. Every single time they go to overtime, it's fun as hell. They could walk in to UD Arena and conceivably drop 95. They also could bring Rhode Island into their building and lose by 20. I truly believe both of those without hesitation. They're so fun to watch. What they do is probably not good for them. They also have five dudes who are just delights. Like Maximus Edwards is the least fun guy in their starting lineup. Think about that for a second with how enjoyable he was throwing down hammer dunks last season. Buchanan's got this awesome old school game. Garrett Johnson's might be in the NBA in a few years. And Stretch just does every delightful thing that a big man can ever do for you.
He did a Mutombo wag to the whole crowd. That was amazing.
And through all of this, their defense is disgustingly bad, which would normally just turn me off from wanting to watch a team, and yet I just don't care.
No, they are very fun, which really isn't that surprising. I mean, I think GW is probably my favorite team to watch last year, and it's kind of a similar style, but just with new guys, and they've found a way to make it work with some mixed results, but that keeps it even more interesting.
So,
all right.
Any thoughts on Duquesne?
I'm not that worried. I mean, it kind of sucks for them. Just I think it knocks them out of the discussion of, at least for now, of getting to that 13 or 14 win threshold. If they beat Dayton, that might change everything. And certainly they're
going to
have
14 at this point because they're not going 14 and 2.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen that since St. Bonaventure, I think, started 0-2 in 2018 and eventually made the tournament. But yeah, it kind of just limits where Duquesne can go this season. But I mean, the double bye race is certainly still there. They lost two coin flips. I think they were between a 1-point favorite and a 1-point underdog in each of their first two games. So kind of lowers like my thoughts on their ceiling, but I don't worry about them going to the pillow fight where I mean, it's possible for VCU right now. It's not out of the woods.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, their depth is actually a problem right now because they have too many guys and they massively flipped the rotation in between those two games in a way that just kind of didn't work. And it was partially a response to the fact that they took Savrasov out of the starting lineup a few games before that, despite the fact that he was starting to play his best ball of the year. And now we've just reached a point that Grant, Clark, Rozier obviously continue to be your three horses. David Dixon has to be a 25-plus minute a game guy for them now. He's playing out of his mind, and he is the best big man on that team at this point. And then you just kind of go from there. I mean, you can start Savrasov, Williams, or Drame as the fourth guy, as the fifth guy with those four. Play the other two off the bench. You can slide Drame to the three. You can slide Williams to the five. And then you can kind of just go on matchup on a given night who gets the rest of your minutes between the Euro guards. And Mohorčić didn't play at all last game. It's probably time to start cutting back on the Khalil Barre minutes a little bit. Hassan Drame is barely playing now. But it's Dambrot loves to screw around with the rotation. And right now, what I think this team probably needs is for him to just pick eight guys, play him some steady minutes. And who knows, in 2-3 games, that might click. And all of a sudden, I would not be surprised at all to turn around and see that this team is like 7-4. Oh, they got to, if Trey Williams is healthy, he has to play way more. That's the biggest one to me.
Yeah, I was surprised to see him play only 2 minutes. And with that happening at the same time as both Richmond and GW winning, I didn't see a ton. Although, is every time I caught a glimpse of the game, it seemed like Duquesne was giving a lot of minutes to Mose Schrute, who even made a three. Or all the other backup guards just hurt right now.
No, I have no idea what in the hell was happening. He's done this twice this year, where all of a sudden Jake DeMichelis, who is a walk-on on a team with 13 usable scholarship players, played 17 minutes in the Loyola game. And you know what? He was actually like a legit solid contributor in that game. He hit a three in a big moment, and it turned out to actually not be an idiotic move, but it's just weird. Like, Mateusz Sharonsky's barely playing. Jakub Netschoss has had his minutes yanked around all season. Now DeMichelis in the rotation. And that's the whole point of what I'm getting at. I don't think Dan Brott knows what he wants to do rotation-wise.
You should just do the Dayton strategy of just only having seven players so you don't really have the hard choices to make. Just keep it simple. But I
God,
think.
if Podejimus and Elvis don't come back, that is actually true, and we're going to see some Brady Yule on the first Friday 10.
It's possible, but I think we need to close it out by talking about Dayton's opponent from Sunday, a standalone game in the A-10 on ESPN2, a rare non-Friday game there. I think UMass got a lot of respect this weekend, even though they didn't pull out the win. But between taking the Flyers to the wire on the road and blowing out Duquesne in the second half, all of a sudden, it kind of in the same vein as Loyola, where I just didn't want to believe in this UMass team and I was looking for ways to doubt them. It's hard to do that right now. I mean, maybe I would say behind Dayton, George Mason, and I guess Loyola, were they the fourth most impressive team this week?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't power rank all the way down to there, but to me, the reason I wanted to talk about this was to basically try to put to bed the question that I think has been kind of stuck in our minds, at least for me, since Diamond Head, where they played pretty well. And the idea of, is UMass actually just pretty good? And I think that this weekend really kind of cleared up that the answer is yes. They should be at worst in the 8-9 game at this point, behind the fact that as I talked about on Hot Takes, I think Matt Cross is just flat out a first team all conference guy now. And he somehow like seemed to suffer two different concussions against Duquesne and was fine, and then lost half a tooth in the Dayton game. That dude's just getting smacked around and still playing the best basketball of his life. And someone just seems to get hot from the guards every game. That didn't happen against Dayton. And if it had, they would have beaten them. They didn't get like the crazy Robert Davis 4 for 6 from deep, or Rashul Diggins was just flat out bad in that game after playing one of the best games of his life against Duquesne. But it's like GW, they're another weird give and take team because you don't know which young guard's gonna show up, but we just know that they're getting something great from Cross and Cohen every night. And I really like these young guards.
Yeah, I mean, I do too. And UMass just didn't get anything from them Sunday. But I don't know. I mean, I came away impressed. I thought Dayton would have no problem. And this might come across as me being the bitter fan who is mad that they didn't win by more. But I kind of don't think the better team won that day on Sunday afternoon. I mean, if UMass doesn't go, they're not a great shooting team, but if they don't go 3 for 22 from three and just make a couple more, which it's not like they were all contested. I mean, they probably come out of there with a win. They just couldn't get enough shots to fall. But all the second chance points, I mean, Matt Cross in particular was just a warrior on the glass, and he was the best player on the court for most of that game, especially in the second half. It's kind of just what we saw from UMass early last season before everything fell apart. They play as hard as any team in the league. And I think that's evidenced by all the second chances they had throughout that game.
And That we felt like that was true at the end of the non-con, and then by like early February, it felt like they had three or four dudes that were still playing hard. Like it was DeAndre Dominguez, Diggins, and Thompson, and whatever center happened to be healthy that day was about it. And I was listening earlier today. Curry Hicks-Sage was on the Golis Standard. One of the best podcasts I've listened to in the last few months on like any topic. So everyone, I highly encourage you to go listen to that episode. Shocker, we put those three on a mic together and they were great. But Sage kept reiterating the point that Frank Martin has been raving about how much he likes this team this year. And if there's one thing that's very clear about Frank Martin over these last 18 months, is that man sugarcoats nothing. That rhetoric was just not there last season. And I think we kind of ignored it. And now I'm starting to really believe in it. And I watch these guys and even the scorers. Like a Jalen Curry has the skill set of a dude that in high school was just dribbling past everyone and scoring. And guys like that half the time just never figure out how to play tough, never figure out how to play defense. And that's just not that guy at all. Every one of these dudes is ready for a rock fight. And this actually is a Frank Martin identity team. I don't think they're going to let up at any point this year. Sure as hell is not going to look like what happened with them last season.
I would argue that Frank Martin's probably raised his stock more than any coach in the A-10 this year. Like coming into the year, I mean, I know I personally picked UMass dead last. I think they were 13th or 14th in the actual poll. And I think a lot of people had questions what he would do with their super inexperienced team that we just didn't know if they had the guards to win a lot of these tough games in the league. But I mean, they look like a legitimate double bye contender. They're going to have a chance at least. I certainly don't think they're going to go away and just completely fall out of the race over the next 2 months. And it is kind of just going to be a matter of if they can keep up that toughness and tenacity over the last 16 games of the year. But I mean, at least after this first week, they're off to a great start, and there's no reason to expect them to just go away.
Yeah, I mean, 11 months ago, people were having legitimate conversations of is Frank Martin too big of a jackass to coach in the 2020s? Well,
Yeah.
and I'm sure some people would take 2 minutes of research on him and say, no way in hell I'm playing for that guy. There's plenty of entitled dudes who would never want to even spend a second with Frank Martin as their coach. He found a bunch of talented dudes who do. And if they get Cross back next year and all they lose is Cohen, I like Daniel Hank at Stanford. He's a guy who actually would play more if they didn't have two awesome guys blocking his minutes. This team might be really building something for the future at this point. And even last year, as much as good as Gupare and Luis looked, it didn't feel like they had the other parts, and it didn't feel like they had the guys that were bought into Martin.
Yeah, I would say the guys right now are, and I guess we'll find out. I mean, it's difficult for teams to retain talent in this era of college basketball, but if all these guys do come back to UMass next year, I think that's a really good sign for the future of where that program's headed.
Yeah, we shall see. Any other thoughts before we pass this off to now? It's a pretty good slate of games this week.
I think St. Joe's is very lucky that they did not play over the weekend, so we kind of forgot about them because my God, what a bad way for them to start the conference season.
Well, and it helped that there were six games going on at that time, and they got a huge first half lead. So, like, they just didn't make it on any of my screens until I think a minute and a half left in the game.
Yeah, pretty much for me,
They're
so.
up double digits on what we thought was going to be the worst team in the league. There was too much other interesting stuff going on. Like, they just weren't worth eyeballs until you blink at the wrong time and find out that they're losing.
Yeah, it's I mean, they started the season with a very easy conference schedule, so they have some chances to get back in the mix, although they also have some chances to make things worse. So we'll find out. Yeah, we can put together put the tournament talk to bed for at least a few weeks.
Yeah, and that we're going to put this episode to bed. We may be back later this week, maybe a potential double for the first time this season. That's not a guarantee, though, but keep an eye out on the Twitter account at the number 3 Bid League Pod or your podcast feed. We'll be sure to let you know if there is a follow-up episode to this, but we thank you for listening to this one. We hope everyone got their nice little Twitter fix today on yet another Monday off day in the A10. Be sure to follow us on that app. Be sure to give us 5 stars if you're listening on iTunes. Leave us a comment on either if you have some commentary, what we're doing well, what we could be doing better. We'll probably have some great guests coming up for you in these next few weeks as we start to see what teams separate themselves in conference play. So be sure to come back and listen in for that.